Welcome to the Perry Johnson Registrars Podcast, where you can expect the latest news and discussions related to the management systems certification industry. Today's episode is a previously recorded webinar. If you would like to tune in to our upcoming webinars, visit our website at www.pjr.com/webinar or give us a follow on your favorite podcast app. Thank you for tuning in.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to today's webinar on root cause analysis and systemic corrective action. My name is Shannon Craddock, and I'm the Programs and Accreditations Manager here at PJR. I'm so pleased that you could be with us here today for this really important topic. To ensure sound quality, all participants have been muted. I'll be fielding questions at the end of today's presentation. Please feel free to type them into the question or chat feature. I can usually get to most of them. So today we're going to be talking about why we're doing this, why this particular topic. We'll talk about the audit finding and its three constituent parts. We'll talk about corrections or actions taken to correct the finding. We'll talk about root cause analysis, what makes a sound root cause, specifically focusing on the why technique, the 5-why technique. We'll talk about corrective actions, which are actions taken to prevent recurrence. And then we'll talk about preventive actions or actions taken to prevent occurrence of an issue in the first place. And then we'll talk about what makes a sound corrective action verification. So why are we doing this? Why this topic? Well, most importantly, we want your organization to improve. And there should be a strong correlation between third-party audit performance, so how you're doing in your certification body or registrar audits, and your quality record with your customers. So if you're doing well on those audits, your on-time, on-quality performance with your customer should be equally as strong. And that's because the purpose of a management systems audit isn't to convince the auditor to write as few findings as possible. Where a finding exists, it should be written, and you need to take systemic corrective action for each and every nonconformity that's found. And that will lead to the stronger correlation. So in order to set us up for good problem solving, we need to have a well-written audit finding. And an audit finding should have three distinct parts: the statement of nonconformity, objective evidence, and a citation of the requirement that's not being met. If you get a written audit finding that does not contain these parts, don't accept it. I'm telling you that you're fully empowered as a PJR client to hand it back to the auditor and say, rewrite it. It doesn't contain the three constituent parts. In fact, if your customers write you a finding, I would encourage you to hand it back to them as well. It really is important that you're set up for successful problem solving, and the input to that is a well-written audit finding. From time to time, our auditors will write opportunities for improvement. These should exist only as statements or recommendations. There's no citation of a requirement that isn't met, because if a requirement was not being met, it would be a nonconformity. So if your auditor writes an opportunity for improvement, it will only exist as a statement. It won't have the three constituent parts. So let's talk about common pitfalls with a statement of nonconformity. And the most common is that often we see the nonconformity recorded is not the true problem, but a symptom of the problem. So in order for problem solving to be successful, we need to express the problem as an issue with the system. If the problem is being expressed in terms of a particular person or one incident, it's at the symptom stage. And unfortunately, not only do I see third-party auditors make this mistake, but internal and second-party auditors also make this mistake. So it's very important to get to the true problem, the systemic issue, or the problem-solving efforts are not going to be effective. Fixing symptoms will not stop the issue from recurring. So let's take a minute and kind of discuss something we can all relate to. In today's times, there have been instances where we've all felt lousy. We've had a headache, a sore throat, maybe we were running a fever. You can certainly take Tylenol or Motrin to alleviate your symptoms, and you may feel better for a while. That sore throat pain may go away, your fever may be reduced. But all the Tylenol in the world isn't going to stop the issue until we discover the true root cause. We're only fixing the symptoms of the problem, and that infection will persist if, for example, it's caused by the strep throat bacteria. You'll need to get a diagnosis of a strep throat infection and get an antibiotic to treat the infection. Taking Tylenol only treats the symptoms. Similarly, in audit non-conforming scenarios, you can't just fix the symptoms. The issue will recur. Additionally, a well-written non-conformity should stand the test of time. Your organization should be able to look back at non-conformities written years ago and understand exactly what the problem was, the breadth and depth of the issue. So let's look at some poorly written statements of nonconformity. Example one, there was no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 indicating competence to run that job. So this is expressed in terms of one person, a first shift operator, in a very specific incident. He's running job 9954 on first shift. Here, we're confusing objective evidence with the statement of nonconformity. We've colluded the symptoms with the broken process. Here's a better way to write this. The system, see, we're using the word system right in the statement of finding. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective, supported by the objective evidence. No training matrix, first shift operator running that job, indicating competence. And then a clear citation of the requirement that isn't met. In this case, 9001, 2015, 72D. And you'll note that we're carrying out that requirement citation to the highest level of detail possible. We're not simply saying 72, we're saying 72D. So the best way to write this is the system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. We're focusing on the systemic issue in our statement of nonconformity, and we're not focusing on one specific incident. We're not confusing this with the symptoms of the problem. Example two. We've got a quality auditor in the blue cell using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Here again, it's a symptom, not the true problem. Again, we're confusing objective evidence with the statement of nonconformity. A better way to write this finding. The document control system is not completely effective. Hey, there's that word again, system. Right in the statement of nonconformity. Assisted it by the objective evidence, quality auditor in the blue cell, using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. All our details are in the objective evidence. And a citation of the requirement going out as far as we can, 7531A. So the best way to write this finding, the statement of nonconformity, I apologize. The document control system is not completely effective. Here we're focusing on the systemic issue and not the symptoms of the problem. So in closing, keep the following in mind. When you review a statement of nonconformity written by a PJR auditor, your internal audit team, or even a customer, ask, have we distinguished between the symptoms and the real problem, the systemic issue? Is that final statement of nonconformity focusing on a systemic issue? And are there data, objective evidence, all the symptoms of the problem, and a citation of the requirement not fulfilled to assist you in understanding the breadth and depth of the problem? PJR has an internal document that's circulated amongst all our auditors. It's our advisory number 3. And it tells auditors to document any non-fulfillment of a requirement as a nonconformity. In fact, we tell them if they failed to do this, it's absolutely inexcusable. There's no benefit to you. You're not going to fix your broken systems. Those issues will recur, and you won't improve your on-time, on-quality performance to your customer. And big picture, it contributes to the diminishment of the integrity of accredited management systems. So it's my expectation, it's PJR's expectation, that all nonconformities written by PJR auditors need to be documented as described. Okay, let's move on to corrections. Actions taken to correct. They're sometimes referred to as containment actions, and they're actions taken with respect to the symptoms of the problem. They're therefore incident-specific actions, and they're very important and should be taken as soon as possible to stop the symptoms from persisting. They typically take two forms. Something like, we calibrated the gauge that was found to be out of calibration, or we controlled the form that was not controlled, or adding a layer of inspection to catch any further occurrence of an issue. But remember, if you're adding a layer of inspection to your system, this is just adding cost. It's not adding value. Later, we're going to see that once a corrective action is implemented, then costly added inspections can be removed from your system. So containment or corrections should be very specific. So if we look at the two examples we've been following, let's consider good corrections. The training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 was updated to reflect his competency to run the job unsupervised. Or all copies of the uncontrolled form the quality auditor in the blue cell was using were destroyed. Corrections also need to include an extent analysis. An extent analysis is also referred to as a look across. So your auditor may have found one instance or two instances during the course of their audit. But how many more are there? What's the depth and breadth of the problem? Our auditors uncovered one or more examples of a non-conforming situation. So they might have found a gauge that's out of calibration, or a document that wasn't controlled, or a training up record that wasn't updated in a timely manner. Let's take a look at some extent analyses that are properly executed. And we'll stick with the two examples that we've been following throughout today's class. We verified the two gauges found by the PJR auditor, 2458 and 1354. Both were conforming. Our extent analysis included the 213 other gauges in our facility. Only one, 5858, was found to be out of calibration, was calibrated and returned to service. No product was measured with this gauge since it was last in a known state of calibration. Okay, so we cite the two gauges the PGR auditor found and what happened with them. Luckily, they were both found to be conforming. We talk about how deep our extent analysis went. It went to all the other gauges in our facility, and there's 213 of them. Only one out of those 213 was out of calibration. It was recalibrated and returned to service. And fortunately, no product was measured with this gauge since it was last in a known state of calibration. So our nonconformity report has been modified to include a blank for extent analysis. We've never made it a requirement to use the PJR nonconformity report form, but if you choose to use your own form, you must still include an extent analysis. Okay, let's move on to the root cause analysis and some common pitfalls when doing root cause. And by far, the most common pitfall is that many cars will restate the incident for the root cause analysis. And this is never acceptable. Two examples. Our organization failed to update the training matrix for the operator running job 9954. Yes, we know that. We told you that when we wrote the finding. You're not telling us why you failed to update that matrix. Or the quality auditor in the blue cell didn't use the correct form to record the results of first article inspection. Again, we already know this. We told you when we issued you the finding. Why was it that that person wasn't using the correct version of the form? Additionally, some cars give containment actions for the root cause analysis. And while this isn't as common, I still see this and it's not acceptable. Okay, if you've wandered and are checking your email or your Instagram page, I encourage you to tune back in. This is the most important slide in today's presentation. A good root cause analysis will answer the question, what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? I'll repeat that. Good root cause analysis answers this question, what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? The focus is on the system, not the incident. In fact, that word system shows right up in that question. It's possible that a problem may have multiple root causes, or a problem may have several possible root causes. If you're unsure of the root cause, all possible root causes will require corrective action until you can figure out what the true root cause is. If the true root cause has been found, you should be able to do what's known as recreating the defect or turning the problem off and on just like a light switch. If the problem can't be turned on and off at will, then you probably don't have the true root cause. And it's common at this point in the presentation where I share a story from my past when I worked in the automotive industry in a large tier one manufacturing organization with facilities throughout the world. I was in charge of North American management systems, and we had an issue with General Motors and mixing left-hand and right-hand parts from a dual cavity tool. And the operators were putting left-hand parts into right-hand boxes and right-hand parts into left-hand boxes. This was causing huge issues at the plant, at the assembly line, and it was a big headache for us. We convened a problem-solving team, and we reconfigured the manufacturing cell so that the pack-out boxes were located in more logical orientations to the packout operator's body. Before, they were directly in line with one another, and they were reoriented so that the left-hand packout box was to the left-hand side of the operator, and the right-hand packout box was to the right-hand side of the operator. And we saw much improvement. We had fewer discrepant reports from General Motors, and the situation was improving. However, we weren't able to turn the problem off. We could never make it completely go away. And while there were fewer instances of mixed hands, the issue was still occurring. We knew we didn't have the true root cause. More on this in a moment. So there are a lot of different techniques for root cause analysis. Is not the fishbone or Ishikawa diagram and the 5-Y technique. Although sometimes you can get there in fewer than 5 Ys. Today, we're going to focus on the 5-Y technique. So let's take our first nonconformity. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. And the symptom of the problem that we saw, that's captured as the objective evidence, no training matrix for the first shift operator running job 9954 indicating competence to run that job. So why was it that the training matrix wasn't updated? Well, our first why, the first shift supervisor failed to update the training matrix as required by the first of the month. Well, why did they fail to do this? Well, before the end of the previous month, the HR manager would email the training matrix template to all the supervisors, but it didn't happen this particular month. Why? Our third why. The HR manager left the company before the end of the month, and a replacement did email the template to all the supervisors. And the fourth why. Why didn't she email the template? Well, the procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt the new HR manager to email the template to all the supervisors, and that's why it didn't happen. Now, this can be somewhat subjective. How do you know you've gone far enough with your why analysis? Some strategies to ensure success. Make sure your 5Y or problem solving team includes people from various disciplines: manufacturing, quality, materials, engineering. It should not be just the management representative sitting at his desk at 4:30, the day before the corrective actions are due to PJR, doing the problem solving. You need input and perspectives from various people. Now, let's get back to the story I was telling about my experience at a tier one automotive supplier where we were mixing left-hand parts and right-hand parts for General Motors. We reconfigured the manufacturing cell arrangement. We moved 3 presses to make that happen to the tune of thousands of dollars. And while the incidence of mixed hands was improving, we didn't turn the problem off like a light switch. So we knew we didn't have the true root cause. So we reconvened our problem-solving team, and we invited a few more people. And we included a third shift material handler that wasn't previously included. And it was this third shift material handler that said, you know, if it was impossible to pack a left-hand part in a right-hand box and vice versa, we wouldn't have this issue. So we worked with our packaging engineers and General Motors and reconfigured the packaging, making it impossible to put a right-hand part in a left-hand box and vice versa. And what do you know? The problem completely disappeared. We turned it off like a light switch. We knew we had the true root cause, and it was the packout boxes that allowed a left-hand part to be packed in a right-hand box. All right, let's look at our second example. The document control system is not completely effective, and the symptom or specific incident we saw is a quality auditor in the blue cell was using an uncontrolled form to record the results of first piece inspection. Why were they doing this? Well, controlled hard copies of the form had all been used in the blue cell, so the quality auditor resorted to an uncontrolled form. Well, why did he do that? Well, the quality auditor in the blue cell was not aware that when no hard copies of a form were available, that the latest version of all forms could be accessed through the company database. Well, why didn't he know to access the company database? He wasn't given a username and password to access the database. Well, why? HR did not have a policy to ensure all new hires are granted a system username and password. So keep in mind some things that PJR will not accept for root cause. Oversight, misunderstanding the requirement, and to be honest, I do have some flexibility with that second one. If it's your first audit, you may not have understood the intent of a requirement. But by surveillance audit 37, we won't accept this. You should understand the intent of every requirement. I forgot two of my personal favorites, another ISO 9001 blunder. A company listed that for every single root cause, or our consultant messed up, and human error. Okay. So let's move on to corrective actions. Corrective actions are different than corrections. Remember, we covered corrections earlier. Corrections are taken to eliminate the symptoms. So taking Tylenol or Motrin to ease your sore throat pain and bring down your fever. You're treating the symptoms. Corrective actions address the root cause. So a corrective action would address the strep throat infection. All the Tylenol in the world will not kill the strep throat bacteria. They therefore should address that very important question, what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? So a common pitfall is that organizations will repeat their corrections or containment actions instead of giving a corrective action. This is not acceptable. Not only should corrective actions address the system and the root cause, but they should be irreversible. That means they should involve a change in the system. And training by itself is generally not a system change. Chances are you already trained people when you launched a project or a new document. And as I said before, incident-specific actions or corrections containment are not irreversible. And in the automotive and some other industries, corrective actions should prompt changes to the DFEMA, PFEMA, and control plan, and may require a new PPAP. There needs to be at least one root cause for one corrective action for each root cause that was identified. Subsequent data show that the problem has 100% disappeared. So returning to my story, when we thought the root cause was the poor configuration of the manufacturing cell, subsequent data showed that the situation was improved, but the problem hadn't 100% disappeared. We knew we didn't have the true root cause. When we reconfigured the product packaging, however, the problem 100% disappeared, and we knew we had the true cause. So let's look at good corrective actions for the scenarios we've been following throughout today's webinar. The system for recording employee training and competence is not completely effective. Our corrective action, section 4.6 of the procedure for training was updated to include a requirement for the HR manager to email the training matrix template to all supervisors before the end of each month. The new HR manager was trained and she added a reminder to her Outlook to perform this task. Does this corrective action address the root cause? Let's scroll back and see. The procedure for training didn't include a requirement to prompt that new HR manager to email the template to all the supervisors. And now the training procedure has been updated. There was a training event, but not just a training event. And an Outlook reminder was added. This corrective action does in fact address the root cause. Now, we'll need to watch this for a while, and we'll talk about verification in a few slides to see if this problem doesn't recur in subsequent months. And our second example, the document control system's not completely effective. Our corrective action for that finding, the new hire work instruction was revised to include a requirement to grant new hires a username and password for the database, and HR personnel were trained on this change. Does this corrective action address the root cause? HR didn't have a policy to ensure all new hires are granted a username and password. And now we revise the work instruction to make that a requirement. That corrective action does address the root cause. Again, only time will tell if we have the correct root cause. Another helpful hint, if training is part of the corrective action response. And again, remember, training shouldn't be the only corrective action. The response should also contain the technique that will be used to verify training effectiveness. Are you going to administer an exam, for example? Okay, let's spend a few minutes talking about preventive actions. Preventive actions answer one of two questions. What other systems exist that might have the same root cause present? Or what systems could I have had in place that would have prevented this from happening? Common pitfall is that many corrective action reports will put corrective actions for preventive actions. But remember, preventive actions address the future and not the past. What could still happen, not what did happen. Preventive actions are going to address the system. They're not going to be at an incident level, because if there was an incident, you would have a true non-conforming situation where you would need a corrective action. Preventive actions involve changing the system to prevent future issues. Preventive actions are not only identified because of non-conformities, however. Management system standards generally require preventive action as a proactive process with inputs from multiple sources. Near miss reports, 5S programs or other lean initiatives, employee suggestions. In other words, no nonconformity should never mean no preventive action. FEMA, one of the best tools for preventive action. All right, and let's close by talking about verification, which is a very critical and often not performed step to round out the problem-solving process. One reason for this is that many CAR forms don't have places for verification at the appropriate locations on the form. So in a sound verification exercise, what should you look at? Well, one, you want to make sure that containment or corrections have been taken. You have done a proper root cause analysis and found the true root cause, meaning you can turn the problem off. And when you recreate that defect, you reintroduce the flawed packaging, for example, the problem recurs and you've turned it on again at will. Once you have the true root cause, irreversible systemic corrective actions have been implemented. Containment actions or corrections that are that costly added layer of inspection have been removed where appropriate, and preventive actions have been considered. When you're doing your verification exercise, remember that corrective actions are meant to be irreversible, but they're often reversible. When you're changing a system, it means you're changing how work is performed. Change is difficult for people. Systems tend to return to where employees feel comfortable. So you may want to continue to verify actions even after you get positive results on the first verification. In fact, I heard statistics that you should be verifying for a period of 6 months at appropriate intervals in that 6 month period before you can close a finding. I would like to acknowledge the IEOB for sharing some of their slide content as an input to this presentation. And I'll now open the floor to any questions or comments that you may have. And again, type those into the question or chat feature. Yvette Khan is asking if the document control system or process is not effective. In my mind, you can use the word system and process in this sense interchangeably. If you need more clarification or I'm misunderstanding your question, just type in a new one. Jake, the slides will be available for download from our website, www.pjr.com, in about 24 to 48 hours. Jeff, this training will be held again. Check out our website section called Future Webinars, www.pjr.com, and that will let you know when this will be held again. Andrew's asking why we stopped at the fourth why. In that particular case, I felt we had encountered the true root cause, Andrew. Remember I mentioned it's somewhat subjective, so only time will tell if the true root cause was identified. Adam's asking, what's the quote for the root cause analysis about what in the system failed such that the problem occurred? So that's it, Adam. What in the system failed such that the problem occurred? Great question from Gabriel. What should be done if an ideal solution to a root cause is too expensive and can't be implemented? Sometimes the best corrective action is cost prohibitive, or it may seem that way at first analysis, but sometimes implementing less expensive corrective actions may not completely eliminate the problem. So I would tread lightly there, Gabriel. Sometimes long-term, the more expensive solution is better. Yes, Bobby, in about 24 to 48 hours, these slides will be available on our website. Our website is www.pjr.com. Muhammad saying, difference between the root cause, why made versus why shipped. Sure, there's a distinction there. You may need to root cause why a bad part was made versus how it escaped. Good question, Andrew. We're not giving certificates for participating in this webinar. Just note that it's an hour webinar and your attendance confirmation or your registration should suffice. Tom's asking if you can stop before five whys, and sometimes you may get there. That's possible. My contact information is on this slide that you're seeing right now. Feel free to reach out to me if you have any additional questions, Susanna, or anyone. Bobby's asking, how often do audits happen? Bobby, I'm assuming you mean third-party audits. After your initial audit, you'll have a surveillance. Those are conducted at 6, 9, or 12-month intervals. By far, the most popular interval is a 12-month frequency. Certificates are granted for 3 years, and prior to certificate expiration, there's a recertification audit. Special audits may happen in response to complaints or feedback we get about your management system. And obviously, customer internal audits can happen at any time. Cecilio is asking a question. For retained documented information of competence, can a company newsletter suffice? So I would think that, and I might be reading into this, Cecilio, that the company newsletter is flowing down some information or training content. So that's training material, but it doesn't demonstrate competence, which by definition is a demonstrated ability or the ability to perform a skill. It may show that they're trained, but you need to prove their competence. Bull is asking if an internal audit should be carried out by a certified internal auditor. Well, if your management system has a written requirement for that, yes, Bola. But in general, it doesn't have to be a requirement. You need to define competency requirements for your internal auditor and then make sure your internal auditor meets those competency requirements. What are some competency requirements that make sense? An understanding of the management system standard being audited, an understanding of your organization's documented information, the ability to interview, the ability to gather evidence and draw conclusions, the ability to write an audit report and a well-written nonconformity. Those all sound like good competencies to me. The ability to stand on one's head and be 6 feet tall, probably not good competencies for an internal auditor. Mohammed's asking if root cause training is a requirement. Root cause training isn't a requirement, but competence in root cause is very likely a competency requirement for some positions in your organization. Michelle is asking, if you evaluate a corrective action and find that you need to change the action during the monitoring period, do you extend the date the car is due or start a new one? I would simply extend the date the car is due, Michelle, as opposed to starting a new one. That way you have that history within that single nonconformity report. Folks, the rush with closing things on a corrective action log needs to stop. That mindset needs to stop. What's important is that you take prompt containment to stop the bleeding, but you need to take your time and make sure you identify a good root cause, implement a corrective action, and keep it open long enough to ensure the problem has 100% disappeared. Rebecca's mentioning that for the standard AS13100, our customer requires lead auditor training. That may be the case, Rebecca. There are a lot of industries where customer specific requirements are important: automotive, aerospace, medical device. There may be supplier quality manuals you have to follow. And if any of those manuals or requirement sets flow down requirements for internal auditor training, you need to follow those. I'm simply saying that the ISO standards themselves, with very few exceptions, don't specify specific training programs for internal auditors. Marquetta is asking, how is competence determined other than by training? Well, training is only one way to meet a competency need. A competency need could be satisfied by self-study and an evaluation, an exam, for example. Perhaps it could be fleshed out by an interview where the interview results are documented by a technical expert. Observation, observing somebody doing a task, can deem them competent. It's important, though, that you create a record of that observation. It's important not to confuse training, which is simply one way to fulfill a competency need, and competence. Interesting point. If after extensive review, a nonconformance truly appears to be isolated to an individual, does the response still need to be geared towards addressing a system issue? There may be some flexibility here. As I said before, there are shades of gray. However, you need to have the subsequent data that shows the problem has never occurred again and it truly is isolated to that one individual. And where that approach fails is an organization will say, this is a one-time thing, a one-person thing, human error, but they never have the subsequent data to back it up. Glenda's asking, what can be done beyond training and changing a QMS document to enforce changes to a system? That's one approach. Changing equipment, adding error proofing to equipment, changing the way training is done, making the training more interactive, re-engineering packaging. All of those are examples. It really depends on the scenario, Glenda. Wait a few more minutes to see if any other questions come in. Thomas is asking, when do other techniques other than five whys work better? I don't necessarily think that a certain type of finding is better suited to a certain problem-solving technique, Thomas. As we wait for more questions, please check out our website, pjr.com, for information on upcoming webinars on a variety of topics, including R2V3. This root cause corrective action presentation will be facilitated once again. AS9104-1, some great stuff headed your way in the future. There is a link to the audio as well. Okay, folks, that appears to be all the questions. I thank you for your time today, and I look forward to meeting you again on future webinars.